Welcome back to the program. Before we begin this segment, I want to play you a little clip. This is a conversation between Woody Allen and Dick Cavett back on The Dick Cavett Show in 1971.
Talking with Woody Allen, we were sort of segueing into the subject of, what is it, 15 years?
No, 13 years.
13 years in classical Freudian psychoanalysis.
Yes, 8 years I was on a couch, and 5 years I was allowed to sit up and face him and chat, and... Yeah. It helped me, I think. I don't know.
How do you know, really? That's what it's always the big question mark for me, is when do you decide I'm done?
Ah, that's a good point. I don't know if you're ever really done. I know that certain characteristics about me are different now than they were when I started analysis. I started when I was 22, and I'm 35. So I have age. That's something.
That is progress, because
yes.
It's upward.
Yes.
Yeah. Can you give any pointers to that thing people always want the answer to, is how do you decide who's the right analyst for you? Did you dismiss or interview any and then reject them?
You know, not me, because I always have blind faith in doctors. You know what I mean? They could do anything they want to me, and I wouldn't know the difference.
Have you had two analysts? Didn't you switch in midstream or something?
I switched after 8 years. I had one for 8 years, and I just used to lay there and talk, and nothing really happened except, you know, that was it.
So how do you decide to switch then? Isn't it dangerous to switch?
Why not switch? You know what I mean?
There's another way of looking at it.
If nothing's happening, I had nothing to lose by switching. So I switched, and now nothing's happening over 5 years.
The fact is, if that same conversation were taking place today, probably not much has changed for Woody, mostly because traditional psychoanalysis is a long, long process. Our guests today have a very different approach, one designed around instant results, some would say a kind of instant gratification. It's no wonder, then, that they've become the go-to therapists for Hollywood. Their office has become a kind of denizen of top actors, directors, agents, writers, and the like. Now they've codified their particular unique approach in a new book entitled The Tools. They are psychiatrist Phil Stutz and psychotherapist Barry Michaels. They were the subject of a lengthy New Yorker story back in March of 2011, and it is my pleasure to have Phil Stutz and Barry Michaels here to talk about their new book, The Tools, Transform Your Problems into Courage, Confidence, and Creativity. Phil, Barry, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Great to have you here. Barry, one of the things that you've talked about is the fact that traditional teaching for therapists and for analysts really teaches you how to analyze, not necessarily to solve problems, which is really what brought you to Phil and set you on this path. Talk about that.
Well, that's the reason that Woody had the experience he did, is because, you know, traditional psychotherapeutic training trains you to analyze problems, but it really doesn't train you to solve them. It would sort of be like hiring a plumber. He comes over to your house. He can tell you exactly why your toilet got stuck, but, hey, I don't get my hands dirty and actually fix them. What really...
My plumber actually does that.
What really excited me when I first met Phil was that he had actual tools. A tool is a specific procedure that you use inside of yourself that gives you an ability to solve a problem. And I know that sounds like a quick fix, but it's really not, because what Phil and I both discovered over time is that when people use the tools continually, they actually found themselves developing abilities that they never knew that they had. So, you know, there's a bias in our society that something that works quickly can't be deep. What I found and what really excited me about the tools was that the tools did both. They worked quickly, but they also worked to evoke the deepest forces in the human personality.
Phil, talk about the fact that these tools have a kind of universality, that while people's problems may be different, that their history may be different, that the reasons that bring them to you and or Barry may be very different, that these tools can be designed to work within those individual circumstances.
Yeah. It's just my nature when I developed them was to look at commonality, to find out what would be the same from person to person. I'm not sure why I did that. It's just my nature to do it. But by doing that, we found the solutions had these underlying forces. We call them higher forces. And the role of a higher force in someone's life tends to be the same from person to person. Just as an example, one of the forces we call the force of forward motion, and there's a tool affiliated with that called the reversal of desire. And no matter what kind of forward motion you're not taking, somebody may want to write a book, somebody else may want to start a business, somebody else may want to change their relationship. They all require forward motion. And I've actually found it helpful to view them all as dealing with the same issue, so to speak.
Can I just add something?
Sure, go ahead.
What I've found about this that's very refreshing is that by focusing on the commonality between problems, the therapy that Phil and I do avoids a very typical problem of traditional psychotherapy, which is, after a while, it kind of gets self-indulgent because each person is reviewing his own personal history ad nauseum. Whereas if you view your own problem in the context of human problems, you're less likely to get so self-indulgent about your own problem and actually focus on a solution.
I think also the idea that you're working on a universal problem and other people are working on the same problem, particularly if they're working on it in a similar way, is very encouraging to people.
Yes.
Does this approach require a certain level of either self-awareness or intelligence or initial creativity in order to be successful?
Well, we pride ourselves in not requiring that. In other words, our motto is use the tools before you fully understand. Use the tools before you fully agree with what we're doing. Observe the results. If the results are bad, go on to the next person.
Mm-hmm.
But if the results are good, you'll become much more open-minded about what's, you know, behind them.
One of the things you talk about is that the tools have an immediate effect, but that to be successful over the long haul, they need to be used repeatedly. Barry, talk a little about that.
Well, that, you know, that goes to the quick fix objection. Yes, the tools do work immediately. When I use, let's say, reversal of desire, that's the first tool in the book, and it's used for people who avoid things. You know, I typically avoid things like phone calls or confrontations, just difficult encounters with people. If I use the reversal of desire in the moment, it will get me to make a phone call or have a difficult conversation. But in order for real change to take place, what I really have to do and what I have done in my life is use the reversal of desire over and over and over again, both to prepare me for a confrontation and even like right before and during the confrontation to keep myself in motion, in facing the thing and moving forward into it. And when you do that, as I said before, you start to develop abilities that you never knew you had. I mean, one thing is it's just much easier for me to confront somebody now than it was 20 years ago when I first started using the tool. So that's the benefit of continuing to use the tools over time.
Is there still an awareness that, take your case, that you're using the tool, or does it become second nature? Does it become in some way inculcated in you?
That's a great question. I would say somewhere in between. It definitely requires a spark of awareness to get yourself to use a tool, because I don't care how evolved you are, it's counterintuitive. There's always a habit of, you know, going back to your old way of doing things. So you have to be aware, this is the moment I need a tool. But when you use a tool tens of thousands of times, like our patients have, it does become second nature in the sense that the tool just sort of takes over. You know, you don't have to go through the steps quite as meticulously as you would in the beginning.
Yeah, and also they get a lot of confidence just the fact that there is a tool.
Yes.
And they know what it is and they've used it 6,000 times. Sometimes they'll even say just knowing the tool is there is enough to change, you know, their reaction in a given situation.
One of the things you talk about is the sense of doing something, the intelligence that is part of just action itself. Talk about that, Phil.
There's a thing we call, what do we call it, Barry?
The intelligence of the will.
Oh, right. Thank you.
No problem.
Let's say we're going to open a donut shop. We're in L.A., so let's say down in Santa Monica Boulevard, we're going to open a donut shop. And we're deciding what flavor donuts to order. And, you know, we could spend ad infinitum 2 weeks discussing and arguing about what flavor donuts to order. What we need to do is open the shop, have people come in. We'll know more about what flavor donuts to order in the first 20 minutes than if we discussed it and studied it, you know, for 2 years. So what we're doing is we're putting ourselves right in the center of the action, putting ourselves out into the world. And that's what we call it, the intelligence of the will, because it takes will to do that, to force yourself to do it.
It's a very, very important point, because most people stay stuck trying to figure out, you know, how they should start rather than simply starting. And there's real intelligence in just starting, just acting.
Yeah, for us, probably the biggest or most common problem we see is the fear of uncertainty. And certainly now, you know, in the United States, things have never been more uncertain. And we try to build people's will up so that they can take action in the face of uncertainty. A lot of things that we consider to be knowledge is just faulty attempts to be certain about the future, which is actually impossible.
One of the things that you point out repeatedly, particularly as you talk about grateful flow, one of the tools one of the five tools that you outline in the book, is that this is more than just positive thinking, that there's a whole different layer to this.
We put this in the book. We found that the power of positive thinking is fine, but the problem with it is the negative thoughts tend to win. I mean, if you're going to be honest with yourself, it's easier to have the negative thoughts than the positive thoughts. And the reason really has to do with the worldview. It actually fits in with what I was just saying about uncertainty. The world is not controllable, and it's just the nature of the human mind that it wants to try to get some control over the world. Like, for instance, worrying is actually a superstitious attempt to control what's going to happen in the future. Now, deep down, you know you can't do that, and you try to worry more and more and more and get more and more control. I mean, Woody Allen is a great example of that. So what the grateful flow does is it gives up trying to predict the future, trying to control the future, trying to control anything. So instead, what it does is it tries to connect you to what we call the source, which is kind of the underlying source of support and well-being for any human being. And you don't connect to the source by worrying or by thinking. You connect to the source by becoming grateful.
Yeah. Just in general, I would say that Phil and I both feel that human beings tend to overutilize their heads and underutilize their hearts. There are certain forces in the human heart that when we become aware of them, we become more powerful. The grateful flow is a great example of that, and I'm glad you brought it up, because when we think about what's going to happen in the future, we're terrified, and our thinking is really a reflection of that terror. When we can feel gratitude in our hearts for what we have now, we actually stop thinking about the future and we can be more present, and there's real power in that. Another example would be the reversal of desire. We all fear doing certain things. You can't really combat fear with thinking. You have to combat it with courage, and again, that's another heart force.
Where does creativity fit into the mix? Barry?
Well, you know, we work with a lot of creative people, writers, directors, actors, etc. But what Phil and I both feel is, and the tools are very, very helpful because it helps them, you know, for example, you know, we were talking about the reversal of desire before and taking action. A writer needs to start writing. There's a limit to how much he can do ahead of time to really figure out what's going to happen in a book that he's writing or in a script that he's writing. He really actually has to dive in and do it in order to know what the thing is about, even to know what the characters are about. So we work with a lot of creative people, but what both Phil and I feel is that there's a tremendous amount of creativity in everyday life. There's creativity in parenting. There's creativity in even the most banal job that you do. And the tools can help make you more creative, in essence, by harnessing forces, creative forces that are in your unconscious.
Yeah, here's how I look at it. Creativity is a journey into the unknown. It's a journey into uncertainty. And when you have the tools, you focus on the only thing you can control at all, which is your own reactions and your own habits. And I think the reason a lot of creative people are attracted to us is because they, and a lot of them are professionals, so they have to create this pressure on them. And we give them a set of tools so that they can deal with the unknown, uncertain aspects of creating.
And, of course, that, I mean, it's an even larger issue in times that we live in, and you alluded to this before, Barry, in which change is so constant and the unknown is out there every day.
Yes. Yes, that's absolutely correct. In other words, for people to really cope with life, they need to be able to think and do in the moment, like right on the spot. And, again, that requires access to forces much more than it requires knowledge, you know, what we call traditionally knowledge or thinking.
Yeah, I mean, for the tools that we have, our definition is a tool has to work. It shouldn't take more than 30 seconds to use the tool. Now, you may have to use it over and over again, but a singular use should be under 30 seconds. The effect of the tool has to be immediate. Otherwise, it has no credibility. Again, the effect may wear off, but you need an immediate effect. And number three, the tool has to work under stress. And we train our patients and almost, you know, specifically put them under excess stress to make sure they can use the tool in those circumstances. And again, that once you're using a tool under stress, you start to develop abilities you didn't know you had, which is usually the most satisfying. You know, like all of a sudden somebody will be a leader. All of a sudden somebody will come up with a lot of new ideas. Somebody else will be much more open emotionally without focusing on those things. We're usually just focusing on a small problem. But that's where the magic of this comes in, where you discover these hidden forces in yourself.
It took me a long time to realize this, but thinking is actually very slow. It's much slower than forces. If you watch, you know, a great basketball player, he can't afford to think. He has to harness forces inside of his body that just simply move and act
right in
new ways, irrespective of his thinking. If he thinks, he's actually going to be way behind the ball.
Which really brings up the question of what is the hardest thing for people to adjust to in taking on these tools, particularly if they've had the experience of more traditional analysis?
I think it's the demand that it places on them. You know, there's something that's a little bit self-gratifying and self-satisfying and constantly going back and talking about the past and talking about yourself and talking about the causes, etc. It's not completely a bad thing, but if you're doing it systematically over and over again, you know, a typical shrink session will be the patient will come in with a problem, the shrink will move it back into the past, and they'll have actually a somewhat comfortable conversation about the past. I say comfortable in the sense that it's been repeated over and over. On the other hand, if you ask the person to change their, let's say somebody's having a problem with their boss and what they really need to do is confront the boss, you could go backwards into their problems with their father and problems with authority figures, et cetera. But in our experience, it doesn't particularly allow the person to confront the boss. So we're saying we're going to give you a tool, let's say the reversal of desire, and you're going to have to use the tool. You're going to be terrified. You're not going to have that much confidence in it. You have to train yourself to use the tool anyway, and then we're going to do it again and again and again, and you're actually going to look for authority figures to challenge and use the tool for practice. That's rigorous. That's demanding of the patient. And a lot of people don't look at therapy that way. They're not actually willing to, you know, that's what we call the price that you have to pay. So, you know, what we're promising is forces that are almost magical on the one hand, but we're also saying the process of developing those forces is very tedious and difficult. So it's a combination. And, you know, hopefully we'll come out in the middle somewhere.
I would just add one thing, which is I think the other thing that's very difficult for people to accept is that not only do they have to use tools, which makes this, again, as Phil said, a very active process, they have to keep using them for the rest of their lives. And that's difficult for people to accept. It's funny because we accept it naturally when it comes to our bodies. You
right.
know, no one would expect to go to the gym and be able to quit once they reach a certain, you know, level. They'd expect to have to keep going. But with our minds, somehow we expect our minds to just take care of themselves.
Yeah, what I always say about the mind is it's like if you bought a flat-screen TV, you know, 52-inch, really beautiful one, you took it out of the box and the whole screen was broken, you say, what's going on here? You take it back to the store and the guy says, they're all like that, they're all broken. And you can get the TV to work, but you got to work on it yourself. And every time you want to watch the TV, you're going to have to keep working on it. It's insulting. Obviously, the TV is a metaphor for your mind. So we like to think our minds are delivered whole, complete, and accurate, and that's actually ridiculous. Also good for shrinks.
Is there a nexus between using the tools in the short run or for dealing with the specific problems and at some point trying to perhaps better understand the root causes for that anger or that fear or those various issues we've been talking about?
There really is. It's interesting what Phil, I think really he was the first person that I heard ever say this, and I think he really discovered it, was that working on your problems actually helps you. It's actually essential to your discovering the root causes of them. Now, that sounds backwards. We're used to thinking, no, I have to discover why I have my problem before I can solve my problem. What Phil, when he told me this, I was kind of amazed. He said, no, work on the problem. Then, from the vantage point of having overcome it a little bit, you'll have a much better insight into how it actually developed. And I have to say that with every patient I've ever treated, that has proven to be true.
Yeah, I think insight and self-knowledge and knowledge of your past should be viewed as a reward for the work that you've done to change yourself. And in that sense, it's priceless. It's invaluable. But it's not going to in and of itself move you. You have to work for it.
Again, to get the plumber analogy going, you know, understanding how your toilet got stuck isn't actually going to help you solve unclog it.
Talk a little bit about how these tools have evolved over time. Obviously, they didn't spring up full-blown. Phil, talk a little bit about how you have come to refine these over the years.
Well, that's a great question. Here's the way I look at it. It feels to me, I mean, this may sound a little nuts, but it feels to me like the tools were out there before I discovered them. And my job was to get as close to the bone as I could, as close to as I could get to refining a tool so that it met our criteria, which, again, as I said, was it's got to be quick, under 30 seconds, it's got to have an immediate effect, and it's got to work under stress. And, you know, the good part about psychiatry is you get recurrent problems. You know, the details are a little bit different for each person, obviously, but the problems recur over and over and over, you know, whether it's fear of authority, inability to discipline yourself, whether it's depression and demoralization, whether it's emotional withdrawal, whatever the issue was. So the patient would come at me with the problem, and I would try to respond and come up with a tool that would fit the criteria. And at first, I didn't even know what I was doing. I mean, that was back 30 years ago. But you'd be amazed when you're given a problem over and over and over again, and you're refining it, you're refining your solution, how much you can get out of that. And it may sound funny, but usually when I had a tool finished, I knew that it was finished. I could feel it, and I kind of go on to the next tool. I should say something else about this, which is the authority figures, the judges of our system, have always been our patients. If it works for the patient, that means a lot to us, independent of the theory behind it. And if it doesn't work, as far as I'm concerned, that's an indictment, no matter what the how much we like the tool or what the philosophy is behind it.
Mm-hmm. Barry?
Very important point that I just want to amplify. Again, there's a kind of a hidden, and I believe unintentional, but a kind of a bias in traditional psychotherapy, which is that if the technique is not working, there's something wrong with the patient. Either he's labeled resistant or more pathological than originally thought or whatever. One of the things that really attracted me to Phil in the beginning is that if what I was doing didn't work, there was something wrong with what I was doing, and I needed to reform what I was doing. So that psychotherapy then becomes much more of a collaborative effort. I listen to my patients, and if they say what you said last time didn't really help me or didn't work or whatever, then it's up to me to refine the tool or to explore further to find out why it didn't work and how we can get it to work.
It's almost similar to, you know, if you look at what's happened in industry, don't know if you know about Deming, you know,
mm-hmm.
in Japan. What happened was about 25, 30 years ago, they started going down to the assembly line, and they would ask the assembly line workers, is there any way to make this process more efficient? And, of course, these guys had a million ideas that none of the suits could possibly imagine why, because they weren't on the assembly line. So, you know, we call that bottom-up information. And obviously, it's not. We didn't come up with that. But I think we've subjected psychotherapy to it probably more than most people have. It's one of the reasons we're so confident in the system that we have.
Phil Stutz, Barry Michaels. The book is The Tools, Transform Your Problems into Courage, Confidence, and Creativity. Phil, Barry, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Jeff.
Thank you.